Welcome to Space Strategy, a podcast from the American Foreign Policy Council's Space Policy Initiative, where we are shaping a vision for the next strategic frontier. Now here's your host, AFPC Senior Fellow in Defense Studies, Peter Gerritsen.
Welcome to the Space Strategy Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Gerritsen, a Senior Fellow in Defense Studies at the American Foreign Policy Council. Today, my guest is General Chance Salzman, the current Chief of Space Operations for the new United States Space Force. He is the senior-most uniformed space officer and is responsible for the organization, training, and equipping of the U.S. Space Force. He is also a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, where he functions as a military advisor to the Secretary of Defense, the National Security Council, and the President. General Salzman is a graduate of Boston University. He was commissioned into the U.S. military in 1991, where he gained operational experience with missiles and space systems, serving as a Minuteman III launch officer, then as a satellite operator for the National Reconnaissance Office. He has also served as the first Chief of Combat Plans for the Joint Space Operations Center, and later as the Chief of Combat Operations. And prior to his current position, he served as the Deputy Chief of Space Operations, Cyber, and Nuclear for the United States Space Force. He has extensive command experience at the squadron, group, and wing levels. General Salzman, thank you so much for being on the Space Strategy Podcast. So I'd like to start with just a simple question. And to those who might not be familiar with the Space Force or the role of CSO, what is your role in the broader space ecosystem?
Well, clearly, when you talk about the space ecosystem, I always think about it as at a minimum of being kind of three components: the commercial, the civil, and the military side of it. Obviously, most of us probably understand the commercial side of things, the capabilities that are presented, the satellites that launch, that provide various services, satellite communications, et cetera. On the civil side, the lead sled dog there, if you will, is, of course, NASA, and focused on research, focused on science exploration. But don't forget, we also have like weather satellites being flown by NOAA, National Oceanographic Administration. So there's some good civil capabilities that provide the country with a lot of important effects. My responsibilities fall on the military side of things. And that's, you know, what we're focused on, is making sure that all of the nation's interests associated with space are protected from those that would try to deny us those space-based capabilities. And this stretches from, you know, everything with protecting commercial satellites that we might need to use in time of war, all the way to things that you might be more familiar with, like GPS or missile warning satellites that we come to rely on heavily on the military side. But the military aspect of this has also grown because our adversaries, our strategic adversaries, have started to use space capabilities to enable targeting of our joint force. And this is probably the most dangerous and destabilizing aspect of what's happened in the space domain. So now the Space Force has a responsibility to not only protect our capabilities, but also deny an adversary the use of their targeting and space-enabled capabilities against our forces. And that's what really has prompted the U.S. Space Force to come into being, is that protect and defend aspect of that. And my role is to lead the Space Force to making sure we can accomplish those missions.
So within that role, what are the problems and opportunities that are sort of first most in occupying your thoughts?
You know, there's so much to do with establishing a new service, and there are so many dynamic circumstances that are playing out really at the same time. The growth of commercial launch capabilities, the absolute exponential growth in small satellite productions that are allowing us to think about capabilities on orbit at a scale that's really been unprecedented in the history of space use. All of those things are kind of converging. So those are a lot of opportunities. How do we take advantage of that? Lower cost to orbit, proliferated constellations. How do we make sure that we are capturing all of those technological advances in support of our military missions? And so that's just a ton of opportunities that we're trying to make sure we're not missing out on. The challenges, of course, are resourcing and providing the guardians, our Space Force guardians, with the skills, the operational experience they need to be able to take advantage of those capabilities, to launch and operate our own capabilities that the Joint Force has come to expect. And so it's not just saying, hey, what we do as the Space Force is protect and defend our interests in space. It's more than that. We have to now see how we fit into the broader context of the Joint Force. We have to figure out how you do that. If I were to summarize the protect and defend as calling it space superiority in the same vein as the Air Force protecting and defending air uses air superiority, then the question rapidly becomes, well, how is it that you intend to achieve a degree of space superiority? And so that becomes the challenge side of this. The opportunity is about taking advantage of all the capabilities that are emerging. The challenge becomes, how precisely do you intend to use it? And that's what I'm kind of focused on here in the near term.
So take us back a little bit. You know, I think many people grew up in a very different world of space, a space that wasn't generally considered to be contested. And so how do you know that it's contested, and what sorts of changes does that force?
Yeah, and I'm one of those people. You know, I spent the first part of my career, probably half my career, 15 to 17 years, basically conducting space operations in a relatively benign environment. And therefore, we focused on two things that were really critical. We focused on efficiency of service and making sure that the services we were providing to the Joint Force were as effective as possible, meaning satellite communications, meaning missile warning and ISR and indications and warning, GPS services, precision navigation and timing. Those kind of services that the Joint Force came to count on, we were there to provide it. But the efficiency piece shouldn't be underestimated. You know, the cost to launch satellites was so large that we really tried to figure out how can we accomplish our mission with as few launches as possible. And that leads you to design very large satellites that have a lot of redundant systems because you want them to last on orbit for as long as possible. That's how you get the efficiency, is that dollar cost averaging. If a satellite can last 12, 15, 20 years even, then it's worth the price of the launch. And you're able to do that because you're not contesting. You're not worried about losing that satellite. How do I know we are now facing a contested environment? Because our adversaries are proving they have the operational capabilities to not only interfere with and deny our capabilities, but literally destroy them on orbit. And we've seen operational tests of those capabilities. And that's both kinetic, non-kinetic effects that they're achieving in the space domain. And so now we have to rethink how we provide those services. If a mission is performed by a few satellites sitting in geosynchronous orbit, they become very viable targets. If we can build a more resilient architect, take advantage of smaller satellites, proliferate a constellation in other orbits, then you create a targeting problem for your adversary and you change the calculus of whether or not to attack the system at all. And so that's, we know there's operational capability to destroy. And now we have to rethink what it means to operate in a contested environment rather than the way we grew up, certainly the way I grew up, flying satellites in a more benign domain.
Now, all this has sort of led you to think that there's a need for a new strategy, and underneath that strategy is a theory of success. So first of all, let's talk about, when you use the term theory of success, what do you mean by that? And can you compare and contrast that with the theory of victory?
Absolutely. And I think it's critical that we do make that differentiation. So I really appreciate the question. As military planners, as military strategists, you know, over the last 20, 25 years now, we've been thinking in terms of the counter-violent extremist organization fight. And we're seeking a better end state. We're seeking how to defeat an adversary. We're putting together plans. And so we think in terms of a theory of victory. How do we win the fight we're in? And I think that's been important and that's served us well. I think now that we're shifting to more of an era of great power competition, the idea of victory starts to seem less maybe the goal. And certainly from a space perspective, I think thinking about competition, not victory, is an important nuance. And so I say theory of success because I want us to be successful. I want the strategy to work. And the strategy can only work if, and this is the way I've kind of framed it, if we can stay in a condition of competition with our adversaries, that is the more preferable condition rather than being in crisis or conflict. And that's what it really means. It's as much about stability management as it is about winning. And so, you know, there's a deterrence theory in there as well. But the idea is, hey, we are in competition with some very capable military powers. The idea would be to maintain stability. And that's why I focus more on a theory of success than how a theory of victory is framed.
Now, as I understand it, you call this theory competitive endurance. So could you outline the broader theory of competitive endurance and the tenets involved in it?
Absolutely. So to the point about theory of success, I called it competitive endurance. One, that word competitive is to focus on competition as being preferable to crisis and conflict. And the idea of endurance, meaning there is no real end state. Like this is stability management with an almost infinite timeline into the future. We want to maintain competition. Do we have the capabilities, the skills, the opportunities and activities? Are we making the right investments to endure in that more stable condition? And so the words competitive endurance are try to evoke that concept. Let's be in it for the long haul, and let's do everything we can to stay in that competitive phase as the most preferred condition. But the three tenets of competitive endurance are about space superiority. It's thinking through this from a space perspective in a contested space domain. And so the first tenet is avoiding operational surprise. You know, we don't experience the domain in the same way that other domains are experienced. I flew in the air just yesterday and I could see how the air works. I could look down on the earth. Obviously, we live on the land. We've all been on the sea. You can experience that domain for yourself and understand some of the nuances about operating in those domains. With space, we operate and we experience the domain through digital interfaces. You know, we collect data about the domain. We interpret it through computers. We interpret it through simulations. Math, quite frankly, tells us what's going to happen in space as much as visual observation. And so avoiding operational surprises about having all the right sensors in place, collecting all the right data of what's going on in space so that we are not surprised by perhaps irresponsible or even hostile activities without our ability to be able to make an appropriate decision and respond to it. The second piece of that I would say is that if we can observe and characterize irresponsible behaviors and attribute it to an irresponsible state or an actor, then that attribution may actually have an effect that keeps us in a more stable environment, reduces the risk of escalation. And so that's why that's an important first tenet, avoiding operational surprise. Secondly, and I'll go into it in more detail if you want me to, but it's about denying first mover advantage. And that's simply to say, right now, as I mentioned, there's a lot of big satellites and a few satellites that perform the missions that might be susceptible to a first strike. You take out three or four satellites, you really hurt our satellite communications. You take out a few satellites, you really hurt our ISR capabilities. So it almost you set up the conditions where a first strike seems attractive. We got to deny that, and we have to deny that. We have to think about different ways to build our architectures to deny that first strike advantage. And then the third tenet is about responsible counterspace campaigning. And all those words are important too, but responsible meaning I can't foul the domain. I can't just decide I'm going to shoot down all the satellites, create a huge debris field, and then expect to use space the way I want to. And so we have to find a way to conduct counterspace operations, meaning deny the adversary the ability to use their space-enabled targeting capabilities against us, but I have to be able to do that in a way that doesn't foul the domain for our own use. I've mentioned in other audiences that if you shoot an aircraft down, a military aircraft down, it falls out of the domain. If you sink a ship, it falls out of the sea lanes. But if you shoot a satellite down at the right altitudes, it could stick around for hundreds of years in the form of debris that could be very hazardous and impose cost on our own satellite systems. And so those are the three elements: avoiding operational surprise, denying that first mover advantage, and then conducting responsible counterspace campaigning.
So let's give you a chance to dig into those a little bit more. So let's sort of start first at the end. Let's talk about the word campaigning. Of course, you know, the joint staff has come out with a joint concept on integrated campaigning. What does campaigning mean to you?
Yeah, in the classic definition, we're talking about a series of military activities that are sequenced to achieve a particular purpose. And that's the way I think about it as well from a space perspective. It's a series of activities. I think the reason I included it in the tenant is because we have to recognize that operational timelines in space might be different than you would experience in other domains. If I have to move a satellite, I need time to do that. But at the same time, when things are moving in orbital velocity, they can happen very fast. And so the idea is we have to campaign, we have to be thinking about it on a day-to-day basis, what's the best posture to be in right now, given the circumstances, and then predict in the future so we can take activities now that will have the effects we need and posture us best should deterrence fail, should we be in a more crisis or conflict type of condition.
So the whole notion of competitive endurance and campaigning, and particularly when you talk about postures, very reminiscent of the terminology I remember in the last great power competition, where there was a sort of a constant one-upmanship, and some characterize that negatively as an arms race, though it appears to be a strategic competition that, that went our way. So when you talk about responsible counterspace campaigning, of course, some are going to hear that as, I'm sure you meant it that way, as building some level of counterspace capabilities. And doesn't that incentivize the other guy to do the same thing?
Well, yeah. The real question is, which came first? You know, this is a chicken and egg problem. Security dilemma is how we talk about it in military terms, obviously. The bottom line is they've already taken that first move. They have both developed offensive capabilities that can literally destroy our on-orbit satellites. And they've also built a space-enabled targeting web that holds our forces on the planet at risk, at range, and with great levels of accuracy. And so if our military is going to be effective, we have to come to terms with the fact that we will have to protect our space capabilities that we've come to rely on, that are so heavily integrated into our concept of joint operations. But we also have to be able to deny an adversary the use of their space-enabled targeting, or quite frankly, we're going to have too many targets of our own that we'll have to manage under that umbrella of fire. So it really is a true offensive-defensive conundrum. And I just have to think about it in terms of contingency planning. My job as a military planner is to have a little bit of cynic in me so that I'm prepared when the president asks for options, that I can give the Secretary of the Air Force, the Secretary of Defense, the Joint Chiefs, a set of options and not be caught flat-footed.
So this is an aspect I think many people sort of queried you about counterspace with respect to denying somebody else attacking our satellites. But many of the listeners in the audience may not have lived through the precision revolution or Gulf War I and Gulf War II. And so this is, and for all Americans, this is probably an entirely novel situation to be facing a space-based reconnaissance strike complex from an adversary. So could you put that in a little more plain speak terms? What does that mean? What does that enable? How does that put our forces at risk? And then what is the benefit, you know, to our forces of being able to deny that and to stability?
That's right. And I think the relative term is over the horizon. And I think that's a term that maybe people can understand. If you think about trying to defend an area and you say, anything that we can see, we want to be able to shoot. And the problem in today's age is that systems can be on top of you so fast that if you wait until they are within your field of view, if you will, it's too late. They can already create an effect on you. And so what militaries have had to do is figure out how to see over the horizon, see beyond what your visual, if you will, allows, and to be able to target systems before they can damage you, before they can destroy capabilities that are in your area. And so with space, you now, there is no horizon. You literally have the ability to see globally around the world. We've been taking advantage of this for years. You eliminate that horizon aspect of it. What satellites also do, as we've seen with our GPS capabilities, is allow a level of precision beyond line of sight. You don't have to put your eyeball through a reticle and target something. You literally can use space-enabled digital positions to increase your level of accuracy beyond line of sight. And so the ability to target our forces beyond line of sight over the horizon in the Pacific Ocean with high levels of accuracy is what causes the problem in the Western Pacific. But I just to, you know, circle back a little bit on the idea of offense and defense, I think it's important that people also recognize that weapons in and of themselves are not offense or defense. I often use the example of, you know, is the F-35 an offensive weapon or a defensive weapon? Is a carrier, a USS carrier, is that an offensive weapon or a defensive weapon? And the answer is it's both. It's the operations that are approved by the Secretary of Defense and the President. It's the operations that have a combination of offensive and defensive actions to achieve military purpose. And our job as services is to make sure that there are capabilities and trained people that can conduct those operations effectively.
So when you talk about denying first mover advantage, that seems to be, you know, very clearly in the realm of stability, of saying, hey, I don't want you to be able to get the jump on me in such a way that it's attractive and easy for you to do that. But when I hear about deny first mover advantage, it suggests a broader potential theory of success in competition. And so, you know, when I think about this, I think about the U.S. broader interests in space and strategic terrain and where we might be able to go, and concern about where our adversaries are attempting to go to higher and higher orbits out. And so I'm curious, when you think about your strategy, is it purely strategically defensive, or is there a strategically offensive portion where you are trying actively as the Space Force to advance America's position in the domain?
The way I'm thinking about it, because I think there's room for all of those discussions that you highlight, and I would encourage those discussions to continue. But specifically for our theory of success, the way I've kind of framed it, it's more about deterrence. And, you know, it's integrated deterrence, and it's our contribution to integrated deterrence. And the thought goes like this: if I can prevent an attack in space, then I can contribute to de-escalating conditions and might actually help achieve integrated deterrence. If I can't, then there could be an attack in space that escalates beyond our control, and we start to get beyond stability management and competition, and now we're in crisis and conflict. And so for me, first mover advantage means, kind of back up here a little bit, as you think about the history of warfare, technology has shifted the balance between what's more effective, being in an offensive position on the attack or being in a defensive position. You know, from medieval times, if you were behind the high walls of the castle, you were relatively secure until the technology of the siege engines and trebuchets and all those things kind of came into being and said, you're not as safe behind those walls as you thought you were. So it shifted a little bit more to the offense. You got to get out in the open to be able to move. Not to jump too far ahead too fast, but just to make the point, the machine gun made defensive positions suddenly much different than a breech-loading musket, for example. And so technology has shifted over time the balance between, is it more effective to stay on defense or go on the offense? But right now, unequivocally, I would say that the offense has the advantage in space for two main reasons. One, we have designed our satellites that are currently performing the missions for largely a benign environment. It's basically the stuff that we built out of the 90s, the early 2000s, and that didn't require us to think about an adversary that could destroy our satellites. And so we built them in that benign environment. And then second is just the nature of space itself. There's not a lot to hide behind. The orbits are very predictable. And so it makes targeting a small number of satellites a relatively easy math problem. And so the idea of denying first mover advantage is to change those circumstances. Increase the number of targets that an adversary might have to attack if it was going to achieve an advantage in a particular mission set. And I think if we can proliferate that out and show them that either they would have to raise the threshold for hostilities and destruction so high to achieve a mission effect that they may not be willing to go that far on the attack. If we can diversify across allies and partners so that missions are shared by multiple countries, again, you've raised that threshold for attack to say, hey, if you're going to go to war against the United States to really close out those missions, you're also going to have to go to war against other allies and partners and attack their systems as well. That all has an effect of creating deterrence because it changes the cost-benefit analysis of conducting that first strike. And so that becomes that advantage that I think we offer to an integrated deterrence strategy. I've seen some discussions about first movers that maybe are mischaracterized in terms of how other areas might use them, like commercial. You know, you want to be first mover to a market as you put a new product out there. That's not what we're talking about. I'm not talking about whether it makes sense to be a second mover to market or a first mover to market. That's not this concept. And it's also not about like a chessboard where is it better to move first or better to move second or who gets to move first. Again, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about rebalancing the idea of is there more of a strategic advantage to be on defense or to go on the offense and rebalance that for deterrent purposes.
Now, it struck me in your characterization something I hadn't really thought about before, which is that a responsible counterspace campaign also has a potential deterrent effect. And so I want to give you an opportunity to maybe elaborate on that.
Well, hopefully we're thinking along the same ways, because that's exactly the way I think about it. If in the course of campaigning, we can demonstrate the ability to disrupt or deny potentially the effectiveness of a space-enabled targeting capability of an adversary, then we might put the thought in their head that says, hey, when we're going to need to be over the horizon and targeting these capabilities, I'm not sure if our space-enabled targeting capability is going to be there for us, because it looks like the Americans having a way to disrupt that, and I'm not sure we can count on it when we're going to need it. And if there's some ambiguity as to whether or not they can close their kill chains, then maybe it will give them pause about actually starting any kind of conflict. That's how I think about that deterrent effect.
So both of these strike me as sort of shades of war theorist John Boyd, of trying to inject uncertainty into the mind of the other guy so that they are less confident in their ability to threaten.
Yeah, I was going to say, add avoiding operational surprise to that. This is all heavily influenced by deterrence, because like I said, that's where we want to be. We want to be deterring hostile acts and managing the stability of great powers in competition. And if you can see behavior before it causes escalation, if you can attribute that behavior, the thing that makes a first nuclear strike improbable is because they know we have the ability to see that launch, attribute that launch, and respond before the consequences of that launch are realized. So avoiding operational surprise is one more element of this deterrent posture, denying first mover advantage and the responsible counterspacing, all working together to create a deterrent effect.
And just to tie that together into integrated deterrence, you know, of course, for a long time, folks have struggled trying to think about deterrence in space. But when you talk about denying first mover advantage, you're not just trying to defend Space Force assets, right? Denying that advantage means the ability of the larger joint force to carry out its mission, right? At least in the way we used to talk about space as being a force multiplier.
Yeah, amen. Thank you for saying that. I've used the bad analogy. I'm famous for my bad analogies. I've used the bad analogy that maybe in the past, you could think about space as being kind of the icing on the cake. It just made it a little better. And now I think it's more about like eggs in the batter. You know, once it's baked, it's impossible to separate. You can't pull it out and retain this. So we do space superiority not for space sake. We do space superiority to be a part of the joint team to make sure the joint team can be effective in accomplishing its military objective.
Yeah, that seems like a very solid case. But of course, I've got to take you to task a little bit on this. And that is, you know, when you read the mission statement of the Space Force, I'm looking at what comes up now, U.S. Space Force responsible for organized training and equipping guardians to conduct global space operations that enhance the way our joint and coalition forces fight, while offering decision makers military options to achieve national objectives. But in law, it says protect America's interests in space. So talk a little bit about how you conceptualize America's interests in the domain, in space, in what is the US Spacecom AOR.
Far be it from me to say that the technical language that's in the law doesn't capture congressional intent. But I've had enough questions asked of me of Congress. I've had enough interactions with senior staff members over there that are part of this to know that they really do mean it in the broadest sense of the term, you know. And so I feel pretty comfortable that the work of the Space Force is really in, from, and to space. That I'm asked routinely about the National Security Space Launch Strategy and how do we make sure we're supporting our access to space to make sure that we don't have a shortfall in our ability to put objects on orbit. It's not really an in-space issue. It's a broader space issue. And we are exploring opportunities in all of the aspects associated with space. And so I'm pretty comfortable that in, from, and to space is probably a better way to describe what's expected of the Space Force, both for the Joint Force and for the nation writ large.
Now, some of the folks who listen to the podcast are folks who are on committees that will be important to resourcing the Space Force. So I wanted to give you a chance to maybe translate these three: denying operational surprise, denying first mover advantage, responsible counterforce. What does that mean in terms of force structures and systems that the Space Force is advocating for in its resourcing?
So I think the easiest taxonomy, and it actually connect to this idea of in, from, and to space. For years and decades, in fact, Air Force Space Command, and then now the U.S. Space Force, has been responsible for maintaining access to space. Largely, that takes on kind of two basic characteristics. Of course, the easy one to see is the launch capabilities and making sure that we have the infrastructure to support our launch capabilities, you know, et cetera. But don't forget that access to space is also requires the control network that establishes the RF links to the satellites so that you can get the data, you can command the satellites, you have the ground networks to move the data that's pulled down. And so all of that network, if you will, is also a critical aspect to accessing what we put onto orbit, both delivering it to orbit and then realizing the benefits through that control network, if you will. So that's the access, and we've been good at that for years. The exploitation of those capabilities, we've also been very good at, and that's how do we make sure that GPS is available continuously at ever and ever increasing levels of accuracy. Satellite communications worldwide for everything from nuclear command and control to just broadband movement of data. Indications and warning to include ISR, weather data, all of those kind of surveillance and reconnaissance aspects that we get from space. Missile warning as a part of that as well. We've been really good at exploiting those capabilities, so much so, like I said, it's the eggs baked into the cake now. The rest of the Joint Force has structured their force designs, presuming they will have access to those space capabilities. What's new is this control aspect. Now we have to defend those capabilities against a thinking, committed, operational adversary. And we have to deny the abilities of the adversaries to use space against our forces. That's the newest piece of that mission. And that's why I focused competitive endurance around that domain control, if you will. But if you think about those three fundamental areas, access to control of the domain, and then exploiting the domain for the purposes of enhancing the Joint Force, you get a more rounded picture of what the Space Force is required to do.
Now, of course, words are both useful ways to communicate, but they can also obscure. So when I hear deny operational surprise, I'm imagining an expanded network for space domain awareness of sensors on the Earth and in space. When I hear deny first mover advantage, I hear two potential things. One is more satellites in diverse orbits, and the other is potential defensive capabilities on or near those satellites. And when I hear responsible space campaigning, I imagine that that is any kind of a counter space capability that doesn't create long-lasting debris, which could be robots with arms, it could be lasers, it could be high-power microwaves, it could be cyber. Are those correct assumptions, or am I off base?
No, I think I taught you pretty well, apparently. The words I was using were hitting home. The word for denying first mover advantage, I do focus on resiliency. Because I feel like if you can absorb a punch, if you can continue to conduct the missions, it starts to change the calculus about whether somebody would attack to begin with. And you can do that through proliferation. We talked about that. You can also do that through diversification, diversifying in multiple types of orbits to create, again, these targeting problems and diversify amongst partners and allies to, again, raise that threshold of what it would take. So it's a it's resiliency through diversification and proliferation that's really at the heart. And so buying those kinds of capabilities would be at the top of my resourcing list, if you will.
So, you know, that almost perfectly leads into the question about how you're executing the strategy with your lines of effort and your C-notes. And so I want to give you an opportunity to talk about those.
Yeah, the lines of effort maybe are a horizontal way of looking at those same responsibilities. So the mission of the Space Force kind of focused on access and control and exploitation into and from space. But then we got to say, all right, no kidding. Where are we short right now? And what do we need to focus on? And that gets to the lines of efforts. And so the line of effort number one, resilient, ready combat forces. I don't want our team to forget that if deterrence fails, we have to be ready. And one of the most powerful ways to deter is to have a credible force that, that an adversary knows is ready to respond. And so resilient and ready is a key aspect of, again, putting together the force that our Secretary of Defense and the President will expect to achieve those kind of options should things go wrong. The second line of effort really speaks to the heart of what I think our success story is, and that's our people. And I use the phrase amplify the guardian spirit really just to say you wouldn't believe the people that, you know, you don't get a chance to go visit guardians as much as I do probably, but it's an unbelievable group of people. They're so talented. They're so capable. They're so dedicated that I've come to believe that the only way for that to be as true as it is that they come into our service having a sort of guardian spirit, this idea that it's service before self. It's the idea that they're patriots, that they want to accomplish something more than just earning a paycheck. They want to push the edge of technology. They love the challenges that are associated with a new service. And they just come in with this spirit. And what I want to do as a service at the, you know, kind of the headquarters level and how you support these people is amplify that. And what I mean is you kind of have to tamp down the frustrations. And it's hard to be in the military. It's hard to move your family around. It's hard to make ends meet on a government paycheck. It really is. And those inconveniences, we've got to do everything we can to tamp those down. And at the same time, empower the guardians, challenge them to be their best self that they can be. And if we can do those things, then we can take advantage of the fact that they raise their hand to serve their nation and keep them in the service and keep their experience in as long as possible. And that's the amplify the guardian spirit line of effort. And then lastly, we kind of talked about a little bit, but we have to partner with the idea that it's not just about transactional. Now we have to partner to win. We have to build mutually beneficial partnerships with industry, with academia, with allies, with other international partners. And if we think about it as a collaborative approach to really trying to win and put together a winning team, I think that's a different mindset. And so I've really tried to lean forward to look at different ways to build those mutually beneficial partnerships.
So, you know, I'd like to delve a little bit deeper into the last one, partnering to win, because I think it's so potentially rich. But before we talk about what all you might be doing in terms of partnering, when you say partner to win, how do you know you've won, or how do you know what winning is?
Yeah, to me, it's an attitude, again, because I don't see an end state. I mentioned that earlier. So, you know, win does imply that we're playing a game and at some point we're going to come out a winner or a loser. That's not really what I mean. It's more like going into a partnership with a winning attitude. We're all going to win by being a part of this collective effort, rather than saying, what can I get out of this? That's not a winning attitude in my mind. And so this is about mutual benefit for industry. I have to recognize that these companies are trying to make monies and earnings per share and all this thing. I have to understand that. I don't have to necessarily wake up every day saying, how do I improve their capabilities? That's not my job. But I do have to understand as partners that that is going to be their concern. Now I got to work together to say, how do we make this happen? How do we team together for mutual benefit? Same with our allies and partners. It's not transactional. It's not, hey, let me have some land so I can build a sensor and pull data from it. No, it's, hey, we all collectively want to understand how space domain awareness can help us, safety of flight, protecting our assets. How can we work together to enhance our capabilities? And so it's about a winning mindset, I think. That's how you know you're winning, is because everybody's happy and sees a mutual benefit to the partnership.
So let's sort of just take it in turn. I'll say, what are you doing in terms of partnering with the combatant commands?
Well, that's a great question. Obviously, our first and foremost combatant command partner is U.S. Space Command. It's our largest service component. 95% of the capabilities we build, we give to U.S. Space Command to conduct their missions. And so we have a very tight partnership with U.S. Space Command. What we're learning as we are establishing ourselves in the more broad joint force concept is, like all the other services, there are component commands in all of the other combatant commands. So every service has a component in all of the combatant commands. And we should be no different. Where we will be different is in size and scope and scale, of course, because we don't have the same numbers that are necessary to be forward. But we've established a service component in Indo-PACOM, led by a one star. We've established a service component in the U.S. Central Command with a colonel leading that group. And we are on the precipice now in the final throes of establishing a service component in UCOM. And we specifically picked those three because those are the geographic commands that are mostly focused on the current NDS threats. And so that's where I wanted to start first. But those service components are right there working directly for the combatant commanders, integrated into their battle rhythms, integrated in, and see the ops tempo. They hear directly from that commander what the priorities are. They're engaged with other nations in the AOR for security cooperation, exercises, and training. And they actually are integrating space in, being the cake batter, the eggs in the cake batter, again, if you will, from the beginning, not just icing on the top after the fact. And so we're seeing a lot of benefit with those three, and we'll be expanding to the other combatant commands in time.
Well, you've been extremely generous with your time. And so I want to wrap it up with a couple of questions. You are known for talking directly to the force via your C-notes. And so I wanted to give you an opportunity to provide your message of what you're asking for your junior guardians. And then lastly, it would not surprise me if we had young people out there listening to this podcast who are considering service to their country. And why might they want to consider joining the Space Force?
Well, I think first and foremost, the junior guardians that are out there, again, I've just been so impressed. And what I would encourage them to do is to not be like me. When I was junior in the service, all I thought about was doing my job. And I presumed that the job would be defined for me. Somebody would tell me exactly what to do. And if I was good at it, I would be successful. That's still necessary in the Space Force, but it's not going to be sufficient, because we haven't built all our processes. We're not sure exactly all the missions that we're going to accomplish. We don't know what the key processes are. We don't know exactly how we're going to train. We don't know exactly how we're going to measure our effectiveness. This is where we need the young people that are in the trenches, literally out there doing the day-to-day mission, to have the courage and the initiative to voice their opinions, to voice their ideas, and ask the hard questions. What about this? What about that? And it's really probably pretty hard to do when you think about being a 22-year-old out there in the field and looking up at the colonels and assuming they have all the answers. And so my plea to them is, don't sit on your ideas. Share your ideas broadly. Your creative thoughts are really what's going to shape the Space Force. And we need to pull those ideas from the junior ranks as much as anybody else. And so the broader people that are considering the Space Force, I hope they heard that. And I hope they hear that the Space Force is where you can go to make a difference. The Space Force is a place you can go to be challenged, because we don't have it all figured out. And we're going to expect you to maybe punch above your weight class, if I can use that metaphor. You're going to be thrown into the deep end and be challenged and expected to contribute right out of the gate. We're going to let you get your hands on some leading edge technology and then push that technology to the next level. And I know there are people that are patriots that are trying to take advantage of some of those skills and think about how they can give back to this great country. And those are the ones that kind of want to attract. And so if those sort of things appeal to you, I think you'll find a home, because you've already got that guardian spirit. And if you come in, I'm going to work hard to amplify it.
General Saltzman, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space Strategy Podcast. Please be sure to subscribe wherever you are listening. For questions and comments, please reach out at spacepod@afpc.org. Thank you for listening.